Morning, everyone. This morning, I would like to discuss, instead of the Parshas HaShavua, which is Parshas Shemini, I'd like to discuss the additional reading that we have tomorrow as part of the special, what we call in Hebrew, in rabbinic terminology, the Arba Parshios, the four portions that we read in anticipation of Pesach. So we already, in the last couple of weeks, we covered Parshas Shkolim. Why do we read Parshas Shkolim?
Because they had to give the
right. Exactly, because that's when they collect the funds. They collect the funds for the new Karbonos beginning in Nisan. That's good. Parshas Zohar, we always read before Purim. Why? Because obviously, we're reminding to blot out the name of Amalek, and Haman Ho'agagi reminds us of Amalek. Good. The last of the parshas is going to be Parshas HaChodesh, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem, Rosh Chodeshim, so that obviously comes before Nisan, introducing the first of the new months, so I understand that one. Tomorrow, we're going to read Parshas Parah. Why are we reading Parshas Parah?
We have to be Tahor to do the Korban.
Exactly, because you have to be Tahor, you have to be not in a state of Tumah to perform the mitzvah of Korban Pesach, and more so, by the way, just to be able to actually go into many sections of the Beis HaMikdash, you have to be Tahar. You can't be Tamei. So this is the topic that I'd like to think about today, this topic of Parah Aduma, and I know, Vern, you weren't so excited already when you saw the title.
Well, as long as it's a cow, and it's a red one, you know, I'm not
he's good.
Worried.
We're so far so good. So I'd like to think about the Parah Aduma today. And even though we have not had a Parah Aduma, a red heifer, in many centuries, and we do not unfortunately yet have a Beis HaMikdash, I think there are still some things that we can reflect on regarding the Parah Aduma that can help shape our view of our religious life today. So that's what I'd like to do, is to give somewhat of a greater insight into this small piece of Parah Aduma. Now, the laws of Parah Aduma are quite complex. There is a whole Maseches of Mishnayos in Seder Taros called Maseches Parah. Right? What's the gist of anybody know the gist of the laws of Parah Aduma? You have a special cow, it's called a... Exactly. Oh, okay. So there was a special ceremony. It's almost like a quite strange idea in that you have I don't want to call it a sacrifice, but a ceremony that's somewhat sacrificial in that the Gemara says that the money for the Paraduma comes from the Bedek Habayis. It comes from the campaign from the Hektish, from the money from the Beis HaMikdash, across from the Har Habayis. It has to be opposite the Har Habayis. They would build a special ramp. The Kohen Gadol, or the Kohen, would go to this place on the, I guess what today we would call the Mount of Olives, Har HaZeisim, Har HaMishcha, right there. And there was a special, like a groove in the ground where they would slaughter and then burn the Parah Aduma. Then they would grind it up and in these little ashes, and they would put it in a special kli, a special kind of vessel, a kli that had Mayim Chaim in it, special water, drawn water from the spring, and then they would sprinkle it on the person in a particular sequence of the third day of their process and the seventh day of their process, and that would be the process of the Parah Aduma. That's like making a long story short. Mm-hmm. So the question becomes, well, when the rabbis analyze this mitzvah, they wonder, what's the meaning of this mitzvah? How do we interpret this mitzvah? And it's important because we very often look to understand the meaning of mitzvahs that we do because they add a certain flavor, a certain appreciation, even though we're going to do them anyway. Right? We're going to do whatever it says in the Torah, whatever the rabbis instruct us, but there is something nice about having a ta'am, a little taste. You eat food not because it tastes good, you eat food because you're hungry. But it's always nicer to eat food that tastes good. So this is what we call ta'amei ha-mitzvos. Ta'am has two levels of meaning, right? The word ta'am means reason, rationale, but it also means taste and flavor. So there is a question, What is the tam, the rationale for the mitzvah of Parah Aduma? Generally, when we look for the rationale, we're only looking for the rationale in terms of understanding and appreciating the mitzvah, not for deciding when the mitzvah applies. Just because, let's say, you were to figure out when you're studying, you come up with what you think is the tam ha-mitzvah, the rationale for the mitzvah, that doesn't regulate the performance of the mitzvah. I'll give you an example. Because there was one opinion in the Talmud, Rabbi Shimon, his opinion is that the rationale for the mitzvah actually regulates the performance. I'll give you a classic example that appears in the Talmud. It goes like this. Lo sachbol beged almana. If you lend a widow and she's going to give you something as collateral, she can't give you her pajamas as collateral or her dress. Why not? So the Gemara says, Rabbi Shimon says, well, you know why? Imagine it, especially in the old days, an almana, what was her social status? And more precisely, what was her economic status generally?
Poor.
Yeah. Right? Poor. She had generally very, very few avenues of support. So you have a poor woman, so she needs a loan. That's why she's asking for money in the first place. So if she wasn't poor, she probably wouldn't be asking for a loan. You have a poor woman who is living alone, generally. A widow is generally living alone. So imagine what would happen. A man comes to her house. And in the old days, remember, very often women would share clothing with each other because they didn't have enough. So it's very likely that this woman has one dress, piece of clothing for the daytime, and one pair of pajamas. That's all. That's all she's got. So what she's going to do is she's going to stand behind the door. The guy who's the creditor is going to come to the house at night, at 8 o'clock at night when she's ready to go to sleep. He's going to give her back her dress. I'm sorry, he's going to give her back her pajamas, and she's going to give him her dress because he's always going to want to hold on to a piece of collateral. So here she is behind the door giving the guy her dress. He's giving her the pajamas. What do you think that looks like? How do you think she's going to feel? What kind of a situation is that? That's terrible. So Rav Shimon says that's why the pasuk says lo sachbo beged almana. You're not allowed to do that. If you want to take a piece of collateral from the house of an almana, so you take her antique clock. You take her antique clock and keep it in your house, but you can't take her dress. It's almost like a violation of her privacy.
What's inappropriate?
Exactly.
I mean, that's the word.
It's totally inappropriate. Oh, and therefore that would be true for a woman who is a poor woman. Let's say you have an almana. Her name happens to be Rockefeller. So she has, she owns hundreds and hundreds of dresses and hundreds of pairs of pajamas. And somebody lends her $10. And for that $10, she's going to give them one of her 500 pairs of pajamas. So do you have to worry about the prohibition of lo sachbol beged almana?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's not sinis. It's not,
Let's say the lender was a woman.
Low-key.
Exactly. We have a principle that says you don't distinguish. The rule is not regulated. You were talking before about regulations. Mm-hmm. The regulations are not malleable based on the rationale. The Torah says you don't take the clothing of an almana, of a widow, that's it. It doesn't matter whether she's poor or whether she's wealthy. It doesn't matter whether the creditor is a man or a woman. The rationale for the mitzvah doesn't regulate the performance of the mitzvah. That's all. And this is true for many, many, many things. So it's important to keep in mind, even though we're going to look for what we as human beings try to perceive as the rationale for the mitzvah, whatever we come up with, that doesn't determine the performance of the mitzvah. That's what we call in the Talmudic parlance, lo darshinan taima dekra. We do not seek out the meaning of the pasuk. What do you mean, lo darshinan taima dekra? What do you mean? The Sefer HaChinuch looks for reasons for mitzvahs all the time. The Rambam and the Mor Nevuchim, the Ramban, everyone looks for the reasons for mitzvahs. That's what it means. It means we don't try to pick and choose the performance of mitzvahs based on what we think is the reason. So we're going to look for the reason for Para Aduma. You're going to do Parah Aduma whether we find it or not.
It's the poster child of Chok.
Oh, very good. So it's the poster child of Chok, Reb David says. what do we say in the pasuk? Zos chukas haTorah. This is the chok of the Torah. What is the chok? What is the connotation of the word chok?
We have no.
You don't know.
We don't know the reason behind it.
Do it, and that's it.
Exactly, and that's illustrated by this medrash that I never saw before this year. Look at this very interesting medrash on page one. We'll translate it together. Shoal goy echad es Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. A Gentile once asked Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, "Ilein ovdaya da'atun avdin. This practice that you do, nirin kimin kishafim, it looks like sorcery that you're doing. Meviim para, you bring a cow. Visorfanosa, as we described before, you burn it. Vikoshinosa, and you grind it up. Vinotlin es ephra, and you take its ashes. Ve'echad mikem mitamilames, and one of you people who is impure because of being in contact with a corpse. Mazin olav shtayim v'sholosh tipim, and you sprinkle two or three drops on him. Va'atim lomlo taharta, you're pure. Says this, look, you know what this looks like? It looks like spooky magic.
Yeah.
Right?
It does.
And you know what? That's the question. Isn't that a good question? Says Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai back to him. Omar lo. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said to him, lo nichnasa b'cha ruach tizazisa miyamecha. Did you ever have like a feeling of madness? Taziza has this idea of like a shigaon, a craziness. Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai asked him, were you ever in a state of like a little bit of madness? Amar lo lav. He says, no, I was never in such a state. Amar lo lav ra'isa adam shenichnasa bruach tazazis. Did you ever see a person who was caught in the throes of this like deranged state? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai has. He says, yeah, I saw such a person. Amar lo, so Rabbi Yochanan says to him like this. Umatem osim lo. What do you do for a person that you saw was in this like state of derangement, of shigaon, of craziness? Amar lo, umatem osim lo. Amar lo, he says, mivian ikarim. We bring roots of plants, umashnin tachtav, and we smoke the plants, these roots of these herbs, umarbitzin aleha mayim, and then we sprinkle water on top of this person, and vihiborachas, and the spirit of craziness goes away from that person. All right, that's the answer that the Gentile says to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, what they do to help this person who's in this period of craziness.
So we take one craziness.
Okay, good.
Cure that craziness with a different craziness.
Good, okay.
With another craziness.
Pardon me.
Where there is no explanation for one. And there is no explanation.
Well, we haven't gotten that far yet. So far, it's the middle of the conversation. Let's give him a chance. Let's finish. So he sees, Amar lo, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said to this non-Jew, Yishma'u oznecha masha atam otzmi picha. You should, your ears should hear what your mouth is saying. Kach haruach hazu, ruach tuma. So too, this spirit that is on the person is the spirit of Tumah. It's the Ruach HaTumah. In the same way, he says to the guy, you understand, it makes a lot of sense to you that you take smoky herbs and some water and you remove the state of, the spirit of,
craziness.
Craziness from the person. So we do the same thing to remove the spirit of Tumah. Dechsev, Vegamis Hanevi'im, Vies Ruach Hatuma Avir Min Ha'aretz. And the Pasuk in Zechariah says, also the prophets and the spirit of Tumah, meaning this impurity I will remove from the land. Mazin Olav Meinida, You sprinkle on him the waters of nida, which literally mean the waters of the estrangement, of separation, but in this context it means the special water of the para atuma. V'hu boreach, and it goes away. Okay, that's the story. So then the goy leaves. La'achar shiyatza, after the guy went away, amr lo talmidav, so the students said to him, okay, no, let's get serious. Amr lo talmidav, Rabbeinu, lazeh dachisa bekaneh, you pushed him away, like with a with a stick. Meaning, what does that mean?
He didn't give him such a great
answer.
Exactly.
He just brushed him off.
Exactly. Now for that guy, it sounds like it was an adequate answer because he was willing to accept the notion of, you know, smoky spices, smoky herbs for a spirit of craziness. But the students are saying, come on, get serious. What is the answer?
If I could just interject.
Yes, here, please.
Native Americans use the burning of sage and other plant products in their ceremonials. They do it. They still do it today.
Really? Okay. So it's...
I mean, this really sounds like... It's... Did the Native Americans know Torah?
It could be.
Well, the Bible is so old that a lot of people in the world...
It's a regular...
still there.
...of their ceremonials, yes.
Okay. So the students said to... Thank you, Rabbi Yochanan and Zakkai. So they said, wait a second. Okay. What's the answer? Ma'ata Omer, what do you say? Omer Lehem, he says, Chayechem, by your life, Lo hames metame, the corpse does not defile. V'lo hamayim metarim, and the water doesn't purify. Ela Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Chuka Chakakti, I etched a law. Gzera Gazarti, I have given a decree. I ata rashai la'avor al gzeirasi. You have no right to transgress, to violate my decree. D'chsiv, as it says in the pasuk, zos chukas ha-Torah. Period. So this story encapsulates exactly what you said. The student said to him, okay, you can make up a story for that person, but what's the truth? And he says, the truth is that even the whole concept of tumah is one which is a gzera. It's a decree, right, and we don't understand it. You meet somebody in the street, you can't tell whether they're tameh or tahar, and you don't know why it is that they should become tameh, they should become tahar, and how they become tahar. He says it's a gzera milafane. And this story really encapsulates the whole discussion. But what's interesting is that even though, on some level, we distinguish between what we could call a chok and a mishpat, what's a mishpat?
A law we understand.
Right, a rule that, and that's why... that's
understandable.
Why, exactly. Yeah. A law which, not that chukim are irrational, they're irrational, they're just not relevant to rational thought. Mishpatim are things that make a lot of sense, especially we usually refer to civic responsibilities as chukim, as mishpatim, because they govern how society runs, like civil law, etc. But the truth is that this concept of chok is actually much broader. And if you look on the next page, there is a beautiful Hasidic teaching of the Holy Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev. Says the Holy Rabbi Yitzchak of Berdichev, Rabbi Levi Yitzchak, he says, Zos chukas ha-Torah. He doesn't focus on the word chukas. He focuses on the word ha-Torah, asher tziva Hashem lemor. Haklal Kitame ha-Torah va-mitzvos heim ne'elomim mikola adam. All of the reasons of all of the laws are hidden from man. Rak ha-adam tzorech lasos ulekayim kol ha-Torah machmas siva Hashem olav lasosim. A person has to fulfill them either way, whether we understand them or not. And that's how he understands the pasuk homiletically. Zos chukas ha-Torah. What is the chukah? What is the rule that we do even if we don't understand it? It is the whole Torah. You do it, whether you understand it or not. Okay, so the first question I'd like to raise today is, and it's been a long preamble, why is it that Hashem decided to teach us this concept that the Torah is transcendent. It's beyond our world, and we can't grasp it 100%. The Shlomo HaMelech says, "Amarti achkama v'hirachu kamimeni." I figured out all the reasons for all of the laws of the Torah, except one, say the rabbis, that's Parah Adumah. Why was Tumah and Parah Adumah chosen?
Because of what follows with Nadav and Aviv?
Maybe it has something to do with Nadav and Aviv, but... But it's even beyond the chronological story and the context in the Chumash. Conceptually, I don't know, for example, we could have made a lot of other mitzvos as chukim that weren't necessarily having anything to do with Tumah per se. Hashem could have, and you think about it for a second, because we're so used to this idea, we often don't step back and ask the question, well, why is Parah Adumah the chok? Why is it something else the chok? Let's leave that question on the table. Let's ask two more questions, and we can get maybe... we'll answer all three questions and come up with more of a cohesive understanding. There is a Mishnah on the next page that I'd like to understand as well. Here we go with another debate. Remember, in the Second Temple period, there was a split in the Jewish community, a very... tragic split between the what we call the Perushim and the Tzedukim, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, those who were the bearers of the rabbinic tradition and those who rejected the oral law, the rabbinic tradition. So here's another conversation. This conversation appears in a Mishnah on the end of a Masechta in Taros called Yadayim, about washing your hands. Omrim Tzedukim, the Sadducees says, Kovlin anu aleichem prushim. We have complaints against you, Pharisees. What's that? Sha'atim etamrim, that you say, kisve hakodesh metamim esiyadayim. Holy books, meaning a sefer Torah, if you touch it, which you're not allowed to touch a Sefer Torah with a bare hand, but let's say a Tanakh, in the old days the Tanakh were written in scrolls, not printed books, in actual scrolls. So those, because they are from the 24 books of the canon, if you touch them with your hand becomes Tameh. That's a rabbinic enactment, and therefore before you eat, you have to wash your hands, and that's actually, I'm just getting one side note, the Gemara has two reasons for why we wash the Tilas Yadayim for bread. One of them is, it reminds us of the days of Truma, when the Kohanim would have to wash their hands, because if their hands became rabbinically impure, they would have to wash them. So that's part of the reason that today we wash for bread. Right? One answer to the Gemara is Mishum Nikias, just for hygiene purposes. The other answer is Mishum Srach Truma, the way that it was in the old days. So, in the old days, if a person touched Kisvei HaKodesh, holy books, their hands would become tummy. Now, the reasons why the rabbis did this, which is not going to be in the Mishnah, but that's part of the Sabbath discussion. Exactly, because in the old days, they wanted to actually keep people away from touching holy books. Why? Because people would have a cabinet in their house, and they would put their holy book, their Tanakh or something there, and right next to it, they would put maybe some truma, if they were a Kohen, or if they were going to give the truma to a Kohen, or they would just put some sandwiches or some bread or something. And because they had easy access, remember, how big were their houses? How many cupboards did they have? They had one cupboard. They put everything in there. So because what would happen was they were putting some food, for whatever reasons, near the Kisvei HaKodesh, what happened? The mice were actually nibbling away at the bread and then at the books. So
for dessert.
Yeah. So all the books were getting ruined. So the rabbis made a decree, you know what? We're going to treat the Kisvei HaKodesh as Tamei Midrabanan. And this way, nobody's going to keep it near their truma or their food or anything like that. And this way, we'll have a special Aron Kodesh for the books, and it won't get eaten up by the mice. That's the honest-to-goodness reason why this halacha is the way it is. But anyway, so they said to the rabbis, you're telling us that holy books are Tamei, V'Sifrei HaMiram, or it could be Sifrei HaMinim. These are books that... these are books that are rebellious, that... heretical books. They're not metame. Eina metame nesiyadayim. Om Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the same sage that we just spoke about a minute ago. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, let me tell you. V'chi ein elanu al haprushim elazu belvad? Is that the only complaint that we have against us, the Pharisees, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai? You see, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was not just a scholar, he was actually also a rabbinic leader in the community, and he was engaging in dialogue with all these various types of people, Goyim and Sadducees. His personality is much bigger than even we could talk about now. Remember, he lived at the crux of this time period. When was that? The year 70, when the Beis HaMikdash was being destroyed. So,
second house. He's the one who saved...
He's the one who saved Yavne, exactly. Okay. So he says, Hari Haim Omrim. You know what they those rabbis say? So I'll tell you something crazy. Haim Omrim, Atzmos Chamor Tohorim, the bones of a donkey are Tohorim, they're pure. V'atzmos Yochanan Kohen Gadol Tameim. But the bones of the Kohen Gadol, they defile. They make someone impure. They keep them out of the Beis HaMikdash. So,
doesn't make sense.
Doesn't make any sense. So Amru Lo, they answered him, I got that. You know why? Lefi chibasan hi tumasan. According to their admiration, their love, their appreciation, that is their tuma. Meaning, the more precious, the more tuma. The more impurity. Shaloyase Adam Atzmos Aviv V'imo Tarvados. A person shouldn't make the bones of their parents into spoons, housewares. Rather, they should keep them at a distance. They should be buried. They should be put away respectfully. Amalahem, so Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai answered them, Af kisvya kodesh, lefi chibasan hi tumasan. Because the books are holier, that's why they have a greater amount of tuma. Now, we said a minute ago that that's not actually the reason. This was just right. The reason that he gave them. Mm-hmm. But let's go back to the principle of the matter.
The holier they are, the more tamed.
So that's the question. Why is that? So let's hold that question number two. Now let's get to the last question. Okay? We're still good? Yeah. Question number one was, why is Par Aduma the chok? Could have been any other chok to teach us. It has to do with Tuma. Right? Tumas Meis, the defilement of the corpse, creates the situation where you need a Par Aduma. Why is it that Kefi Lefi Chibasan Hi Tumasan? That's question number two. And then there's question number three. And that is that if you notice, whereas maybe in other cultures, there is an interest in, and maybe an obsession almost, with death. Judaism, we're not so into death. Right? We don't make a big deal about death. And actually, if you look in strictly halachic sources, there's not much discussion dealing with the dead. There's the question of how to respect a person once they have passed away. But for our purposes, there is almost a danger in being involved with death. There's something called Doresh El Hamesim. There was some necromancy or some type of like speaking with the dead spirits that exist in the ancient world. The Torah says that's an Issa Doraisa. That's absolutely prohibited. That's why famously Shaul, King Saul, when he was in a tight spot, he brought up Shmuel HaNavi through this method of necromancy. And Shmuel says to him, how dare you do that? You violated what it says in the Chumash. Once the deceased are gone, they're gone. And not only that, in classic rabbinic sources, the idea of going to graves, it's not very popular. So much so, that if you think about it, even, you know, the grave of Moshe Rabbeinu is hidden. It's hidden from us. So even though there is a Kabbalistic and a mystical tradition in terms of prayer, but in terms of worship of Hashem, we're not into, you know, we're not obsessed with graves, and quite the opposite.
The Egyptians built pyramids.
Right.
And tombs.
And they made it into a big focal point of their lives. For Jews, a cemetery has never been a focal point of our existence. So much so that it's even quite the opposite. Now, we're not sensitive to this today. We're not sensitive to this day because, unfortunately, we don't live with a Beis HaMikdash. But if we lived in a time, and hopefully one day it'll be very soon, where there was a Beis HaMikdash, we would be very, very attuned to the laws of Tumah and Tahara, purity and impurity, and specifically when it comes to becoming in contact with a deceased, going to a funeral. You know, I have this because I'm a Kohen, so I went recently to a funeral. So here at Chicago Jewish Funerals, they built a very nice box, right? They built a penalty box for the Kohanim, a separate little room. We have a video screen. But imagine if somebody had been saving up, they did something terrible, God forbid. They required a korban chatas. Korban chatas means they negligently violated a sin which ordinarily, if it had been done volitionally, would require them to be liable to kares, spiritual excisement. So they save up, they're going to buy an animal. So first of all, animals are not cheap. They have to save up quite a bit of money, and they have to plan. When is he going to take off of work, and when is he going to go to the Beis HaMikdash? And then all of a sudden, punkt, somebody in the neighborhood passes away. So then he asks the whole question, is he really going to go to the funeral? Or is he going to stand outside? Because if he goes to the funeral, he can't go to the Beis HaMikdash. So he's going to have to reroute his whole trip. So then he has to, you know... we're not sensitive to that at all. But in the old days, if you were going to go to the Beis HaMikdash to bring a korban, if you were going to go for one of the Shalosh Regalim, the three festivals, or more importantly, if you were a Kohen, you never get involved. You have to stay away. And you're very, very sensitive to that. So then the question, because why not? Why is it that the whole idea of Tumah, there's nothing wrong with Tumah, it's not bad, but why is it that we distance ourselves from it? Why is it that Tumah, it's the antithesis of Kedusha? What's the limitation there? So what I'd like to suggest is an answer to each of the three questions that we raised, and through that, we come up with maybe a better understanding of death, but the process of Tumah and how it relates to everything. And I think it comes down to actually one pasuk that appears in Parashas Re'eh, of all places, regarding the following law. There is a din of called Srita. What is the din of Srita?
You cannot scratch your...
Right. In the old days, when people would lose close relatives, they would cut themselves on their arms or on their heads or on their body as a sign of mourning for the dead. And the Torah tells us, instructs us, we're not permitted to do that. We're not allowed to cut ourselves.
To harm ourselves.
Specifically in the context of mourning.
Yeah. To over grieve.
Exactly. It's part of, exactly. Take a look on the next page. It's the first pasuk.
We just not cut the begging.
Exactly. We just cut the cloth. But this is the first pasuk in the 14th chapter in Sefer Devarim. It's a Parashas Re'eh. The Torah tells us the following. Bonim atem l'Hashem Elokeichem. We are the children of God. He's saying to us, you are the children of God. Lo sizgodedu. Do not cut yourselves. Velo sasimu karcha bein einechem l'meis. And don't carve a bald spot between your eyes for a dead person. So what does that mean? So, Vern, you are Mechave, and you already identified the explanation here of the Ibn Ezra and the Sforno. They both make the same point, that you can't grieve too much. Too much grief is not appropriate. Why not? So they explain the following. So, Ibn Ezra says, V'tam, why? Acha sh'teidu sha'atem bonim l'shem v'hu oev eschem yoser mikol av. You know why, he says? Because the first part of the verse, you are the children of God, therefore don't overgrieve. No matter what happens, no matter how calamitous the person's loss may be, and it may be calamitous, you still have God. He is our Father, our Mother, our King. So therefore, you have to mourn. You say Dain HaEmes, God forbid, in a bad situation. You rip clothing, but don't overdo it. Why shouldn't you overdo it? You're totally destroyed. The answer is you can't be completely destroyed because God is still there for you. God is still your Father.
Right.
even the most awful, awful situation, there's got to be a limit to your grief. Make sense? Because that's the rationale. The first part of the pasuk is the frame for the second half. But the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, Rav Chaim ben Attar from Tzfat, early 17th century, on the left-hand side, he says something even deeper.
Also,
he says, yeah, well, just one second, let's do the Or HaChaim first. Tzarech Ladas, he says, I have to know, Ma Tam, why, Samach Ma'amar, it juxtapose the statement of Bonim Atem, you are the children of God, Le Ma'amar, to the statement of Tis go to do, cutting. He says, I'll tell you why. Nira Shiniskaven, the intent is, Lomar, Shebemisas Ish, when a person dies, Ein Aveda Lames. The deceased is not lost. Hudhare Hudome La'odam, Sheshalach bino l'schora le'iracheres. It's like a person who sent their son on a business errand to another city. Uliyamim, and a while later, shalach ha'av achar bino. The father sends the son. He says, "It's time to come back." Ve'ein hedar aben ela min hamakom shalach misham. The son, he didn't cease to exist. He's just not where he was before. He was over here before, and now he's going back to where the king sent him. Aval al kolpanim yeshno. He still exists. Va'adaraba letov lo shachazar haben eitzel aviv. It's better. Now, just one very important caveat. I'm not suggesting that anybody should ever say this at a funeral or at a shiva house or to somebody who's grieving. That's not what I'm suggesting. But I think quite the opposite, and this is why I entitled the talk the way I entitled it, even though it wasn't so exciting to Vern. It's important to talk about this when we're not, God forbid, in the throes of that kind of situation, when we can integrate this idea into our thoughts. Says the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, he's still there. And not only that, he goes back to his father. And he's happier where he is, and he's in a better place. Obviously, again, I think it's a terrible idea for somebody to come to a shiva house and say, oh, you know, I'm so sorry to hear about your father, but you know he's in a better place. You know what? For me right now, he's not in a better place. I'd rather him right here.
Right.
But the idea is that Jewish people believe in a soul. We believe in a transcendence that goes beyond the physical world that we can feel, see, and touch. There's something that's greater, and that's the spirit, that's the neshama. In every person, we have a neshama. That neshama is a spark from God, so to speak. It's like the child. That's the parable here, is that we are children of God. Why? Because we have a spark of God. And I would add something even further. Banim atam l'Hashem Elokeichem, that means we're all brothers and sisters to each other because we all share that same spark of God. So that means that when a person passes away, any individual should grieve, but they shouldn't grieve to the point where it's as if the person is actually gone, because they're not gone. Their neshama still exists. The neshama still exists, it just went back to the place where it came from. And after 120 years, we'll all go together with all those neshamas, all those souls. And not only that, the Zohar HaKadosh says, the holy tradition teaches that the soul is still here. Certainly, for example, during the Shiva, that's why people sit Shiva in the person's house that passed away. Even so, so much so, God forbid, let's say a person passed away and they had no relatives. Never married, no siblings, no children. We had someone like that in Washington Heights. It was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, a big tzaddik. He was a blind man. His name was Rabbi Yosef Wenevsky. Big Talmud Chacham. And he was blind. He lived in an apartment all alone. His parents had passed away, had no siblings, no children. So you know what happens in such a case, such a tragedy? They sit Shiva in his house. And that's what happened. People came. There was a Nicham Avelim, but there were no mourners. But because the neshama is still there, so to speak, whatever that means, the soul of the person still exists. That's why the Zohar HaKadosh teaches that when it comes to, for example, family simchas, so we have this tradition that the souls of previous generations are still there. You know, my grandfathers are in the world of truth, but I don't believe that they're not connected. They don't feel a connection to what's going on in this world. There's no question that it wouldn't be for my two grandfathers, Zichronim Levracha, I would not be sitting here today at all. All the Torah that we ever learned in the last 6 years since I've come here to Chicago together is because of them. You know, they put my parents through Jewish education. They built homes that were Torah Jewish homes. So what, they're not connected to me? Of course they're connected to me. I carry them with me every day. Wherever I teach, whatever I do. All the neshamas of all the people that came before us. So therefore, we grieve. We need to grieve. But not too far, because this concept of transcendence exists for Jewish people. Well, if that's the case, maybe I would suggest to you, this is the answer to the first question. Why is it that dafka, specifically in the context of death, and tumas meis, defilement of a corpse, we start to talk about a chok, something we don't understand? That's precisely why. Because the answer to death is to understand that there's something beyond human comprehension. And that's the soul. There's something that we can't measure. We can't put our finger on it. And that's exactly the correlation. When a person is tamei because they went to a funeral, they feel like, oh my gosh, my world is falling down. It's crashing down. And you know what we tell the person? Do something that's otherworldly. Do something that has mamish, not a single shred of logic to it. And the person is going through the process. Is like, why am I doing this? Why am I doing this? You know why I'm doing it? Because God told me. Because there's a God in the world that endows us with a spirit. And that spirit is exactly the neshama that just left the world. So in a certain sense, maybe it's almost like a cathartic type of consolation to the person. That when they're going through the process, it reminds them that even though they face death, there's still a spirit that lives on. You had a hand.
Well, no, just in that context, when you talk about soul and they're still with us, I mean, that's why, unlike other religions, we light yahrzeit candles, we say Kaddish.
Exactly.
Yahrzeit. I mean, we do things always to commemorate those that have gone before us. And, I mean, that would be part of the retaining.
Absolutely.
The memory of the soul.
Exactly. And that's Yizkor, right? Obviously, right. That's Yizkor and other things like that. That's why some say that we call Yom HaKippurim. All right, this is a little too far, but Yom Kippur is also a day for the souls to be judged. So, but this idea, and this was my first suggestion, this was, maybe it's a chiddush, I didn't see it anywhere, but the idea that a chok reminds us of transcendence, and that's the response. Why do you have a parah adumah? Because you confronted death. That's suggestion number one. Question number two we asked is, why is it that kafi chibasan hitumasan, the more lofty or noble something is, the more tamei there is? So perhaps this gets the root of what the problem is, what the issue is of tumah in the first place. And that, and we're a little short on time, but just I'll regal achas on one foot. Tumah is a spirit of a vacuum. When there is a potential for godliness, when there is a potential for life, and life and godliness are synonymous, which is lost, the absence of that potential, that's the state of tumah. That's ritual impurity. That's why almost all tumah comes from something that was alive. It had vitality. It had godliness. It had a spirit of God in it. And when it lost it, there is the vacuum of godliness. That vacuum of godliness is tumah. That's why there's no tumah, let's say, on a rock. A rock doesn't become tumah. It never had any potential in the first place. So you're not, you don't feel any negativity there. There's not even, but, let's say, when a woman goes through her period, why is there residual tumah for a woman? It's not, it has nothing to do with her. It's not that there's anything wrong with her. It's that the reason why she's having her period is because, biologically, there was the potential for life. Exactly. And for whatever reason, this particular cycle, that potential was not realized. So the simple equation is, when there is a potential for life and the life is lost, there is a vacuum. That vacuum is tumah. Same thing, you have an animal that's walking around, it has the potential to be eaten, it has the potential to serve in some capacity, and then when it dies, it no longer has any potential. But now we can understand that the more potential that something has, the greater the vacuum exists when that potential is gone. Kafi tumasan, kafi chibasan, kach tumasan. The Kohen Gadol, or for that matter, any person, any human being, has infinite potential. That's the whole reason why God created us, because He gave us unlimited potential to accomplish in this world. So when any individual human being ceases to exist, so then that potential is all lost in this practical world. So on the one hand, step number one is we are a soul, but we are a soul in a body because we're supposed to accomplish something. The soul is here to partner with God in bringing perfection to the world. Well, when that particular soul goes home, well, it leaves behind a vacuum of all the things that it was doing that are no longer here. So therefore, because of the fact that there is a soul in the body that has a goal, and when that person passes away, there's a vacuum that person played in the role of their family, their community, their life, that leaves behind an empty space. That empty space is the void of Tumah. But now this explains the last of our question, which is why is it that we don't obsess over death? It's particularly because of these two variables. Number one, we said that death reminds us, and that Tara from Tumas Meis reminds us that there is a soul, because the soul left behind something, a vacuum, a life that was snuffed out for whatever reason, whatever time, that's no longer going to be producing anymore in this world. We don't obsess over it for that reason. Why? Took a look on the next page, and we're not going to take the time to read the whole thing. I gave you both pages from a selection from Rav Soloveitchik in English from Halachic Man, where he talks all about death. And he's discussing here why it is, and I gave you both pages, you can read it more by yourself, but I'll just, the second column, the last paragraph, on page 6, many religions view the phenomenon of death as a positive spectacle, in as much as it highlights and sensitizes the religious consciousness and sensibility. This really starts at the beginning of the chapter, right here on the left side, but I'm not going to take the time. They therefore sanctify death and the grave, because it is here that we find ourselves at the threshold of transcendence, at the portal of the world to come. Death is this window, seen as a window filled with light, open to an exalted supernal realm. Judaism, however, proclaims that coming into contact with the dead precipitates defilement. Judaism abhors death, organic decay and dissolution. It bids one to choose life and sanctify it. Authentic Judaism, as reflected in halachic thought, sees in death a terrifying contradiction to the whole of religious life. Death negates the entire magnificent experience of halachic man. When a person dies, he is freed from the commandments. The customary Jewish practice to act like the people of Lorraine, who remove the tzitzis from the shrouds of the dead, constitutes authoritative teaching. Explains. To repeat, halacha is devoid of any positive orientation to death and burial. On the contrary, it refutes these phenomena as negative from a negative perspective. Why? And he explains. Page 7, left-hand column on the bottom. The halacha is not at all concerned with a transcendent world. Amazing. We don't care about Olam Haba. The world to come is a tranquil, quiet world that is wholly good, wholly everlasting, and wholly eternal, wherein a man will receive the reward for the commandments which he performed in this world. However, the receiving of a reward is not a religious act. Therefore, halachic man prefers the real world to a transcendent existence, because here in this world, man is given the opportunity to create, act, accomplish. While there, in the world to come, he is powerless to change anything at all. What an amazing idea. The reason why we stay away from death is because we are charged with a mission. Death says, there's a spiritual world where everything is good and everything is placid. It's static. They're what we call in Chazal, omdim. They're standing. They're stationary in a certain sense. They can't do any more mitzvahs. Halachic man, Judaism says, no, we weren't created. The whole point of creation wasn't to have a bunch of souls, disembodied souls. For that, God didn't have to create the world. Why did he create the world? For us to be active, to clothe the naked, to feed the hungry, to fill it with the spirit of Torah, to bring God into the world through tefillah, to mend the whole world. That's why we're here. If we're going to sit around and sublimate death, we're going to ultimately end up sitting and meditating at the top of a mountain because we're just going to be yearning for a transcendent existence. Says Rav Soloveitchik, that's not what life is about. Life is about doing and living. And that's why we stay away from death. So I think it's actually like this kind of interesting dialectic. On the one hand, death is the end of the person, and we need to be, we actually counter that by remembering the soul. And that consoles us. It makes us feel better. That's why we have the Chok of the Paraduma, to remind us that it's all about the soul. And that the reason why there's Tumah in the first place is because the soul was accomplishing something and now it's not there. But even though it's all about the soul, says Rav Soloveitchik, it's not about the soul at all. And that's why we don't get so involved in death. Because really, it's about this world. If we got too much involved in the world of Para Aduma, or the world of the supernatural, we wouldn't be focusing on living the here and now. We'd be meditating off somewhere. Says Rav Soloveitchik, we're supposed to be bound up with the performance of commandments in this world. Holiness, he says, and with this we'll close, means the holiness of earthly here and now life. So how do we deal with death? In this kind of complex way. On the one hand, we need to remind ourselves about the soul. On the other hand, we can't become too preoccupied with the soul that it should take us away from accomplishing something in this world. And I think all of these are things that we can think about when we read the Para Aduma. That's the story that we're going to read tomorrow, Parshas Chukas.